looking for something different. Your radio may have settled on KPFT and stayed there. If you're new to this station, here's how community radio works. We rely on listeners, not advertisers, for the money that we use to operate our station. We hold membership drives a few times a year, and we ask for you to support our work with a pledge. If you give a call to 713-526-4000 and ask for the membership department, you can pledge an amount of your choice to support KPFT. You've come to rely on us, but we rely on you. That's 713-526-4000. Ask for the membership department and support KPFT, or go to kpft.org to pledge. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
That cool beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. Thursday, welcoming you to So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT Houston. I'm your host, Hank Rubicek, and alongside a team brimming with talent, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, co-hosts Eric Heen, Christy Gorman, Harwood Taylor, and Tatiana Gago, we bring you the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on astonishing journeys before returning us safely to the present. You know, there's nothing good about the coronavirus. The physical side effects are too numerous to name and too real to fathom. The good news is that healthcare professionals suggest that these side effects may be temporary. But how about the more lingering and painful byproducts? According to Shots, the health news on NPR, mental health professionals already know something important, and that is that one consequence of COVID-19 is an increase in domestic violence, often created by a combustible tension fostered by stress and isolation. There's a story about Keisha Preston of Roanoke, Virginia, who said her husband was always borderline abusive. But after a few months in isolation, he attacked her on social media, posting insults and accusations up to 35 times a day, and monitored her comings and goings through their home security system. He always was hiding in the bushes, hoping to see something, she said, anything that he could act on, she shared. Talking to a friend, muttering something about him under my breath, anything that he could jump on. Preston, a student, and their three children suffered greatly. Her husband beat her and their oldest child daily. She finally mustered enough courage to leave, despite having nowhere to go but a shelter. Well, Keisha is one of thousands in shelters for the same reason. As a child growing up in Boston, David Leong's formative years were filled with verbal abuse and violence, but unlike Keisha Preston, he didn't have a clear sign about what inspired each cruel gesture. But he did learn to address it, big time. And although the reasons for the abuse may still have been somewhat elusive, how to return to a healthy soul was as clear to him as a flawless diamond. And tonight's important collection of stories will help make this point. David S. Leong is one of 18 people in the United States holding the rank of certified fight master, and his scenes have been showcased in stage and cinemas across the country and abroad. The New York Metropolitan Opera, Porgy and Bess for one, Billy Elliot, Carousel, Hamlet, Macbeth, and so much more. David is a professor emeritus at Virginia Commonwealth University, where he served as chair of the Department of Theater. Our Facebook page offers a more comprehensive billing for this remarkable man. But here's one fact I cannot leave unsaid. He reports having over 50 former graduate students currently hold full-time faculty positions at colleges and universities across the United States. But I think he forgot to include me. I may be retired, yeah, sort of, but I was one of his grad students when earning my doctorate at the University of Maryland. Still, he never forgot our friendship, which spans decades, and was renewed recently after David connected with me when learning that I had COVID-19. You know, David, we've talked a few times, but this is really a fun way to celebrate our renewal, huh?
Absolutely. Beautiful. Thank you for having me.
Fun. Oh, are you kidding? My pleasure. David, you know, we were raised in the same world, one of sitcoms laced with Lincoln-esque messages, Crayola crayons, Bosco, old school superheroes. One hero had a special effect on you, Zorro, the swashbuckling action hero created by American pulp writer Johnston McCulley in 1919. Now this takes us obviously to your first story called Zorro Meets Bruce Lee. Tell us the story.
When you were a kid, who were you for Halloween? I was Zorro. He was my hero. But I didn't wait for Halloween. That was only one night. I needed to be Zorro a lot more than just one night a year. You see, when I was a young boy growing up in Boston, there were many, many nights a year when I'd grab my plastic sword, I'd don my cape and mask, I'd turn up the TV really loud, and I'd swash my buckle all over the house, and I still have the costume to prove it. I also have a Zorro lunchbox and a Zorro thermos, too. But the real reason that I turn up the TV really loud was to drown out the sounds of violence when my father beat up my mother and my brother. You see, when I was really little, I had no choice but to watch it and cry. But when I had my Zorro costume on, I felt a lot safer and I felt a lot stronger. Now, 10 years later, after lots of therapy and mentoring, I was asked to choreograph a play called Extremities. It's a powerful drama with a lot of domestic violence. And it reminded me of what it was like when I was a child. I actually have a 10-second audio clip I want you to hear. Now, not surprisingly, I started to see a therapist at the same time for PTSD, triggered by what I'd experienced as a child when I was working on that show. And after a few sessions, she said to me, David, I need to come watch you work. And so she did. And then after watching me rehearse with the actor, she says, I thought I was going to watch you stage some fights, but I was surprised at what you did before that. You did all these exercises to make them feel safe before you started to choreograph the fights. You don't choreograph fights, David. You choreograph trust. You see, what happened was this. When I was preparing to choreograph that stuff, I read a Bruce Lee quote that really grabbed my attention. Empty your mind, be formless, and be shapeless like water. Now, when you put water in a cup, it becomes the cup. When you put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. Be water, my friend. That Bruce Lee quote was one of my early aha moments. You see, if you're going to have actors fight with each other, they need to be like water. They need to work with each other. There's an ebb and a flow around each other. So I created a whole series of slow motion exercises, and I call them water meets water. And while they are working, I'm actually studying them. I'm watching them. I'm watching to see if they have any fears, to see what their tension is, to see if they're going too fast, to see if they listen, to see what their physical and emotional limits are, and a lot more. It's actually a bit more complicated than that. But what I'm saying now is that the actors, well, they were doing something that was violent. Well, it looked violent without it really being violent. You see, when I was younger, when I watched those at home go at each other, verbal and physical blows, you sort of have no choice but to feel, to listen, and learn. I learned to recognize my father's body language, so I knew exactly when he'd pick up something and he'd throw it at my mother. I could hear the subtle change in my mother's voice when she'd get ready to scream at my father, and I could feel how hard my dad hit my brother just by the sound of his cries without even watching it happen. So I use that in my fight choreography. Now, I don't think there's a single person on this planet that doesn't have battle scars. We've all been wounded somehow. It's just part of life, some of us more than others. But many of us choose not to look at the past. Some of us want to blame it on others, but I believe if you're really willing to get some help and willing to look at your life's big challenges, you'll find at least one thing that you've gained, and I call that a ninja skill. You can use that ninja skill in life if you want, or those ninja skills. So I'll end my story with this question for everyone. What's your ninja skill?
Well, we all need one too. We all need one. You know, for me, I think it's a matter of keeping journals all of those years. It gave me a chance to get rid of all of those hidden agendas and really learn to circumvent conflict intelligently. But that is such a profound thought. We all have ninja skills. You talked about extremities. Our listeners will remember Farrah Fawcett in the movie. Very, very powerful. Very powerful. And I love the image. You know, the image of you turning up the TV, listening to Zorro, while your father was abusing both your mother and your brother is, I don't know, that paints a very vivid and a very symbolic picture. You know, what impressed me most about Zorro is that unlike a lot of contemporary heroes, he was against killing for any reason, and he'd avoid killing anyone in a fight. Our lunchbox heroes, as I like to call them, didn't like the kind of violence, but, you know, domestic violence is, well, you know, it's violent. I get how you think that you were choreographing your childhood, but tell us a little bit more about choreographing trust.
Theater actors, unlike TV and film, are different. TV and film actors, they're trained stunt people. Oftentimes you bring in doubles to do all the really, really, you know, the tough physical violent work, the fights. In the theater, you don't have that. They're actors. They don't have that kind of training, Hank. They come in raw. They don't know each other often. It's not like they've worked together. So I have to see how all their fears and their strengths, and I have to create a new process every single time I work with them. And that it's a little complicated to describe right here, but it literally is creating trust exercises that are different for every single actor in every single play or musical.
Wow. Yeah, you know, trust is like, it's like an eraser. The more mistakes you make, the smaller it gets. Very interesting. You know, you taught me about story dramatization, and one of the steps in story dramatization is trying on a character. And you certainly did that with Zorro with a lot of great results, but your next story points more to you trying on several roles, which I guess culminated into you finding yourself. This one is called I've Got You Under My Skin, in case anybody doesn't know the song.
Yes.
And they probably don't, David, because most of our listeners are young. I want everybody to know that David is the only person on the planet older than me. So if we make references, like this, they understand why.
That's the Four Seasons in Frankie Valli, everyone.
Right.
Okay, here we go. I'm sitting at the DMV typing vigorously in my computer. In my peripheral vision, I notice a Caucasian middle-aged woman with medium brown hair smiling. And I can see that she's leaning over and she kind of wants to engage in a conversation. Now, normally I might be so absorbed in my work that I don't notice, but today I'm happy to stop and talk. I reach out my hand and I say, hello, my name is David Leong. Nice to meet you. She extends her hand with a big smile. Thank you for introducing yourself. I'm Phyllis Freeman, so what do you do? So on most days, I'm very cautious about how I answer that question because there's three or four different ways I can answer that. But today I said, well, I work at Virginia Commonwealth University. She looks at me and she says, oh, are you a doctor? I hesitate, now wishing that I hadn't engaged. And then she takes another pause and she looks at me. And then she says, you must be in math or sciences, right? because she sees my Asian blood. She sees my dark hair. I said, David Leung, I don't know why, but today I blurt out the one thing that I hardly ever say to anyone that I don't know. Well, actually, I'm in the theater. I'm in the entertainment business. I'm a fight choreographer. And now she looks at me like she's seen a ghost. Well, I won't tell you the next question she asked me, but I will give you the answer. No, I say, I am not Bruce Lee. Don't you know that he died a long, long time ago? And believe it or not, people ask me the same question about 50 times a year. They ask me so much that I'm now prepared. I've prepared another answer that stops them dead in their tracks. Oh, I'm so sorry that I'm not Bruce Lee. He died almost 40 years ago. Nice to meet you. My name is Jackie Chan. So why is it that people automatically decide who you are and what you do just by the way you look or by the color of your skin or when they hear your name? Actually, well, now when people think that I'm Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan, I'm sort of okay with that. But it took me 35 years to grow into my skin as an Asian American artist to get that way. Hey, slant eyes, go back to China. Go back to China. That's what I heard every day growing up as a child in Boston in the 1950s. And when you hear that, you just feel it all the way down to your soul. It cuts really deep. Hey, Chinky, you don't belong here. Ching Chong Chinaman. I'd say go back to China. My head felt like it would explode. And I wanted to run away. But I can't, because I can't crawl out of my own skin. And after hearing that year after year, I didn't want to be me. I was ashamed to be Chinese. Now, when I was about 7, we moved out of Boston to get away from all that stuff. So I grew up in an all-white town. I went to an all-white high school and college, and I started my career as a university theater professor and a professional fight choreographer. But here's the scariest thing. After 20 years of growing up with that kind of environment, I discovered that I had successfully run away from my own skin. And that to me, was even more shameful. You want to know how out of my skin I felt? One of my favorite things to do on Sunday was to read the New York Times. I love sports and I love arts, but I felt guilty if I wanted to read the sports section first, because I'd hear a critical voice in my head that would keep saying, you're Chinese American, David. You're supposed to be a doctor. You're supposed to be a scientist. Anything else but who you are. One night, I was watching Johnny Carson, and one of his guests was a Chinese American actor named Rosalind Chow. I don't know if you remember. She was on MASH, and then she was one of the lead roles in After MASH. Johnny Carson asked her what it was like growing up Chinese in America. And she said, I don't know, because I thought I was white. I didn't want my father to pick me up after high school because then my friends would know I was Chinese. It wasn't until after I went to visit relatives in China that I began to realize who I am. I'm Chinese and American. I'm Chinese American. After that, I literally felt my skin start to regrow around me. Just hearing that someone else has the same questions I have or is going through the same thing, that was really therapeutic. Now, I don't know about you, but the weight of not being who others think you should be just wears you down. About the same time as her interview, I was hired to choreograph the fights for a play in New York with an all-Asian cast. It was transformational. For the first time in my life, I hung out with other Asian American theater artists who played poker, who drank beer, and read the sports section before the arts section. That was their normal, and it was skin that I wanted to grow into. I really felt that I crawled back into it. Well, it felt more really like that I was regrowing my skin. It's like a snake that sheds it and then regrows. That happened when I was 35. I read a story just last week about Billie Jean King, and she said that she didn't grow into her skin until she was 51. And though I struggled to find my cultural identity growing up, I'm fortunate that my parents allowed me to choose my own career path because they weren't so lucky. My dad grew up in China, and he wanted to go to Paris to study painting, but his father wouldn't let him. His father dictated, you must be an engineer. So that's what dad became. And though my daughter never met my father, she is now what he always wanted to be. She's a professional artist, and she's in her own skin. My mother wanted to be a pianist, but life got in the way. And though my son never met his grandmother, he is now who she wanted to be. He's a pianist and a conductor. He's also on the board of directors for Wear Yellow Proudly, an initiative that brings awareness to Asian culture and strengthens the ties within the global community, especially during this time, during the global pandemic. I know he's in his skin, and I can say with great pride that so am I.
Fabulous. All these years of teaching, and I'm sure you can relate to this as well, I can't tell you how many students, when I ask them, what are your career plans? What do you want to do? So many of them, probably half, say things like, well, my dad wants me to do this. My mom wants me to do that. My parents have plans that I go into their business, whatever it might be. And, I tell them very comfortably, because I obviously don't want to create any kind of conflict between them and their parents, but I tell them, you've got to be able to define yourself. That's a hard thing to do. But when other people try to define you and you buy into it, it becomes utterly, unconditionally exhausting.
I used to be chair of the theater department, and in orientation, I would say to parents, I'd have that conversation with parents, Hank, and I'd say, okay, how many of your parents have decided what you want your kid to be? They all raise their hands. And I said, how many of them will you really like the idea that they're going to be theater artists? And none of them raise their hands. And I say, well, let me ask you this question. If you were lucky enough to go to college, how many of you are doing right now what you planned to do when you went into college? Hardly anyone raised, they don't.
Yeah.
I said, give them a break. Please allow them to find out who they are.
Yeah. Well, it happens every day. It happens too often. And there's no doubt that that has an awful lot to do with overall human productivity. The majority of people hate what they do, and they have so many resentments. It's not play, it's real. It's a tale of transformation. And it's a story that compelled you to dig particularly deep after some, I would say, poignant discoveries. To tell us that story.
It's July 24th, 2014, and it's my very first day in prison. Scattered around me are inmates that look like they're about to start a riot. And right in front of me stands Tufari, 6'4", and built like a heavyweight boxer, and D, a head shorter but bulked up with muscles like the Hulk. And all of a sudden, they go berserk and they start punching each other. The inmates close in, and I'm trapped right in the middle. It is terrifying, but it is fantastic. You see, I choreographed that fight for a production of Macbeth at the Woodburn Correctional Facility in upstate New York. It was part of a program called Rehabilitation Through the Arts, designed to give inmates real-life skills they can use on the outside. So let's go back about 3 hours before that scene. The play director, Gary Sloan, gathers the inmates around and says, hey guys, I'd like you to meet David Leong. He's choreographed a lot of famous actors, plays, and movies like Kathleen Turner, Sam Rockwell, Sigourney Weaver, more and more. He said, but before we begin, does anyone have a question they'd like to ask David? Right away, one of the inmates shoots his hand up. He walks right up to me and he says, okay, we know all about your fake fights, but we want to know if you've ever been in a real fight. I stage fake fights. I'm not a street hood. What can I say to impress them? Nothing. Nothing but the truth. So I look him in the eyes and I say, well, yes, I have been in a real fight. When I was a kid, I used to fight my father every time he beat up my mother. I had to do it for years. So yeah, I've been in a lot of fights, more than I want to remember. After a long moment, he kind of rests back, and all the other inmates, they uncross their arms and they smile. He says, all right, Bruce Lee, let's get it on. So here's what happened. On our way to prison, Gary, the director, says, David, I can tell you're really, really nervous. So here's what you do. Take off your mask and be real, because to them, they're not doing a play. To them, this is real. At that very moment, he said, they're going to test you. I don't know how they're going to do it, but they are. And at that very moment, the inmates and I had, we had something in common. My being real created trust. And when that happened, we began our collaboration. And collaboration it was, because we weren't allowed to use swords. Obviously, it's in prison, duh. So I said, okay, guys, these are, you know, normally big battle scenes. What should we use? And one of the inmates says, well, can we cut them out of paper? And another one says, well, can we make them out of rubber? I wanted to laugh, not at them, but I kind of wanted to laugh with them, because I was captivated by how much they bought into this whole thing about collaboration. We ended up creating our own language. What we did was we used their right arm as a sword and their left arm as a shield, and they bought into it. So slow motion, exercises, trust, we choreographed the fights, they're ready to go. Now it's opening night. It's actually opening day, because the play was performed in the prison cafeteria in front of inmates and guards and personnel and so on. At the end of the play, the 6'4" Tufari, as Macbeth says to Stocky D, lay on Macduff and damn be him that cries, hold enough. And they start to fight. And guess what? They fight and then they start improvising, making stuff up one blow after another, until finally Stocky D picks up giant Macbeth, throws him off stage. That is not in the choreography. The entire audience gasps in unison. They all hold their breath as if, and everyone just stares at Tufari lying on the floor. My brain is going, my head's about to explode. Then Tufari pops up in one piece. He runs up the aisle, happy as a lark. The audience goes berserk and stands up with cheers and applause. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, this is amazing. This is what a fight is supposed to look like. This looks more real than what I see when I choreograph professional actors on Broadway. Now, I know those of you that are listening, I know what you're thinking. You might be thinking, well, these are violent men doing what got them there in the first place. But you know what? In rehearsal, these inmates had really learned how to listen. They learned how to trust and how to collaborate. After the show closed, the inmates sent us some thoughts about working on Macbeth. And I'd like to end with this. One inmate said, I learned how to be flexible. Another one said, I learned how not to get caught up in my selfish issues. And a third one said, I learned what it's like to step outside myself to benefit the group. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd say that's about as real as it gets.
You know, if you're lucky enough to engage an inmate in conversation, there's nothing like it. For many years, I was doing training with the HPD, Houston Police Department. And I was on several field trips. We would take field trips to the Huntsville prison because sometimes I would go down to the Law Enforcement Management Institute, which is at Sam Houston in Huntsville. And one time I was down there, and I was up there, and I was talking to some inmates. And I was kind of bold, and I asked one inmate, I said, you know, you must have some bad days in here. You must have some good days. You know, tell me about your best day. Or your worst day. I don't know, just drumming up conversation. And he looked at me rather harshly. He was a badass. And he said, you've seen the movie City Slickers? I said, yeah, I did. You know, with Daniel Stern and Billy Crystal and Bruno Kirby. Yeah. Well, remember when they play that game and Billy Crystal and Daniel Stern turns to Bruno Kirby and asks him, what's your best day and your worst day? And Bruno Kirby doesn't want to play. He says, you guys want to play? I don't want to do it. Well, they finally got him to play. And Bruno Kirby said, okay, best day. I'm 14 years old. I'm in my house. My father comes home drunk like he does every day. He beats up my sister. And then he's coming over to beat up my mother. I'm standing in front of her. He pulls back, ready to swing and hit me. I don't budge. He smiles. He laughs. And as he leaves the door, he says, you're welcome to your burden. Best day. And they ask him, well, what was your worst day? And he said, same day.
Wow.
It's amazing, right? You know, that whole transformation in just a matter of minutes. Yeah. This is Hank Rubicek. This is Hank Rubicek with my friend and guest storyteller, Virginia Commonwealth University Professor Emeritus David Leong on So What's Your Story? Only on Pacifica KPFT, Houston, and 91.9. for our friends in Huntsville as a matter of fact. You know, I wasn't surprised to learn that after all these years, David, it was our mutual love for storytelling that really helped to connect us. And the power of storytelling is really in its innate ability to connect people, right?
Yes, absolutely. Without a doubt. It just cuts right to the core, and that's what joins us at the hip.
So true. You have to disclose quickly. It really gets to the core of a person. Very, you know, I always believe that personal narratives stretch the boundaries of the human heart. Well, the notion of staying at home, I think bothers a lot of people in today's world, but your stay-at-home lives doesn't mean no chance for human connection. Not if you turn to storytelling as a method for embracing those you love. And even in a pandemic, there are terrific venues to help you develop some very cool storytelling skills. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. when we return to our face-to-face world. We're going to be meeting at Temple Emmanuel on 1500 Sunset. But for now, we're having a ton of folks from all over the country zooming in and having a ball. Visit the Guild's website at www.HoustonStorytellers.org for the link and for information about all of our upcoming events. When you're on that site, please enjoy our past So What's Your Story programs, all of them since 2008, listed on the menu under radio program. There's no need for radio when you're tuning in every week, and why wouldn't you want to tune in every week to this award-winning program? Because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org. Get to know us by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and be sure to share it with your friends. And you know what? I would love it if you like us when you leave. If you have any program ideas, guests, maybe even yourself, let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpfd.org, and we promise to get back to you. Our friends of the Moth may not be packing into Warehouse Live, but you can catch them online, including nationwide story slams that you will love. Matter of fact, there was one last night. And for anyone wanting to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? David, you know, the image of inmates lunging at each other would make the most macho among us shudder, I think. But for you, that was a version that unfolded into something entirely different. It's called Practice What You Prevent.
So who wants to go? I mean, I need a volunteer. That voice was Dr. John Parakas. He was the therapist and the counselor that weekend. He's probably in his 60s. He's not a big man, but his presence is very intimidating. And when he looks at you, it's like he can see right through you. I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia, attending a weekend men's sexuality workshop with a group of 29 other men. And when I say men's sexuality, I don't mean it's not a workshop focused on being more or less sexual. It's really a workshop in helping men get more in tune with their feelings, more in tune with their bodies, in tune with their relationship, and generally more in tune with life. So who wants to go, said Dr. John. I look around the room and recognize that there's only one person left who hasn't gotten up, and that's me. So I stand up reluctantly. Dr. John looks at me and says, so David, what do you want to work on today? I pause for a while, and then I start to talk. Well, he cuts me off right away. Never mind. Let me tell you what I need you to work on. I tremble inside. If you want to become whole, you need to get your mother's fear out of your chest, and you need to put your father's anger into your hips. If I was really scared before, now I'm completely frozen. And then he places a stool in front of them in the middle of the room. He put a pillow on top of it. And he said, let's work on putting some of your father's anger into your hips. Here, take this tennis racket. But before you do that, I want you to pick someone out in the room to stand in as your mother. So I pick someone out, and they stand about 10 feet away from the cushion. He says, now, grab this tennis racket, And I want you to be your father. I want you to slam it down on the stool, scream at your mother all the frustration. I want you to scream. And while you slam it into the cushion. So I grab the racket and I stand up in front of the pillow. I do nothing but stand there for a long time. I'm frozen. Come on, slam it down and scream if you want. I'm frozen with fear. And all I can think about is, I can swing a sword, but I can't swing a racket. And you know what he then said to me? Why are you afraid of your father's anger? And then I say something that I've never said before, even to myself. Because I don't want to be him. David, you're not your father. You told me your father died a long time ago. And with his passing, you gave away all that power. But I no more talking. After what seems like an eternity, I hear a firm voice say, come on, David, we'll do it with you. And he gets everyone to stand up. And they all sort of pantomime having a racket. And they start to just scream and slam it down. But I don't. After a few more minutes, I go into it a little bit more and a little bit. I managed to swing once. That was it. That's all I could do that night. A couple weeks later, I go back. And again, I'm the last person to go. I swing a couple of times and everyone gets up. And I'm able to get it. And it feels good. I mean, it feels like there's some power coming into me. I slam it down and I scream and it feels really good. And he says, David, good job. And then he says something that changed my life. He said, David, you must practice what you want to prevent. That was another big aha moment. You spend your whole life getting rid of it, but don't you know the more you run, the closer it gets? So I was able to do that. I felt good. I slam it down, and then I finally weep. I break down. And then he says, great. I say, oh, thank you. And I go to sit down. He goes, no, you can't sit yet. I said, what do you mean? He goes, we're not yet done. I said, what? And then he says, okay, great. Pick out someone in here to be your father. We're going to do this, and you are going to be your mother. Oh, my God. So I start the whole process over again. I pick someone out to be my father. He says, you are your mother, and I need you to scream. I need you to forget about that fear. You need to get that fear out of your chest. Bring it back. So I start reluctantly. I get it more and more and more. And then I fall into it. It feels good. It's transformational. And I get pretty good at it. Well, after a few more weeks, I get up there and it's a breeze. It feels good. It doesn't feel like I've inhabited. It feels like it's part of me, but I've embraced it and I feel whole. And you know what happened? I loved it. I felt a newfound energy in my body. And you know what? My fight choreography became more diverse. People used to call me to do domestic violence. That was my thing. But now they started calling me to do these balletic sword fights, these beautiful dance pieces. And then not only my fight choreography, but more importantly that, my relationships got better with my kids, my partner, and with my life.
You know, it must have been so easy to do a ballet on your father's buttons, huh? Must have just been. Now you make it very clear in your TED Talks, and I love this point, that it's really important for people to be able to name their buttons, right?
Yeah.
Give us an example of what you mean by some of our buttons. I mean, I know our listeners know what you mean, but give us an example of some of our buttons.
Well, okay. So let me start with this, just in case someone doesn't know what a hot button is. A hot button is something that really just gets you all riled up. You know, it's an adrenaline rush and you kind of lose it. And sometimes people act on it and sometimes they don't. But a hot button, an example, here's a couple of most common hot buttons that you see. Like Hank Rubichek might get upset. Like you have hot buttons. You might be someone who's unreliable. Let's say you might hate it if someone's late for meetings or whatever. So that's your hot button's called is unreliable. You might like someone who dislikes someone. One of your hot buttons might be someone who's self-centered, and that's your hot button. But you know what a hot button is? A hot button is actually something that it's you. It's something that violates your expectations about how you think they should be. You have set standards. You said you always have to be on time. You can't be late. You can't be self-centered. So your hot button is a person that's unreliable or a person that is self-centered. Now, so why is that important? Because when you can recognize your own hot buttons, you can go, okay, I know they're late, but this is my hot button. And you can choose to respond to it in a way that doesn't kind of set you off.
So important, so important. Your last story is really the perfect story to end this program, because it's a peaceful emotional path back to your mom rather than the harsher corridor occupied by your dad. You know, I was mentioning to you the other day that for me, it's sort of like beginning this show with pain and ending it with peace in my own mind. And it is called Welcome Home, Mom.
My mother was about 4'11", petite frame, and a beautiful blend of Chinese, Australian, Irish, and English blood. She was just very shy and unassuming. Now, when I was about 9 years old, she was also raised in Sydney, Australia. Now, when I was about 9 years old, largely due to my mother's love for music, I took clarinet lessons, and when I got good enough, we played together. You know the song Waltzing Matilda? She played Waltzing Matilda over and over again, and I would join in, and all we did was laugh. We laughed. It was like there wasn't a care in the world. And sadly, my mother died in 1990, and she never had a chance to go back to Sydney. But before she died, she told me that her sister Stella had put some family documents into the Sydney Public Library way back in the 70s. And then what happened was, I forgot all about it. And then just last year, I contacted the Sydney Public Library, and they send me a link, and they click on it and said, yes, we have it. I open it up. There's 5 boxes of family documents and hundreds of photos, and I'm excited. I'm like, you know, just like a kid in a candy store. Oh, my God. It's like uncovering a treasure. So I book a flight to Sydney for my wife. We go into an Airbnb because I booked the Airbnb, so it was only about 20 minutes walk to the library. Soon as we get into the Airbnb, I get a text from my brother that says, look for 20 Brisbane Street, David. I said, and I text him back, what's that? He goes, that's where mom was born, and that's where I was born. And I say, oh, my God, my brother Bill, Sydney's 5.3 million people, 4,800 square miles. I'm not going to be able to find 20 Brisbane Street. And that was 1924 when she was born and raised there. This is like 100 years later almost. The very next day, my wife and I start walking to the library, and we stop at a crosswalk. We look up at the light to change, and guess what? Brisbane Street, about 5 blocks from the Airbnb. It's Brisbane Street, and we say, oh, my God, we walked down 3 blocks. There's 20 Brisbane Street. Now, it looks different, but it's 20 Brisbane Street. We go to the library. We go into special collections, and they give me the special gloves, and I start looking in. One box has hundreds of photos, pictures of my mother when she was a child, and pictures of me that I had never seen before, including one of me playing the clarinet. Okay, I kid you not. So I start taking these photos off, and the librarian comes up, and she said, you know, I'm taking pictures of them. She said, no, you cannot shoot any of these. This is rare collections. And I said, no, I came halfway around the world. And she said, no. And then she stops. She picks up a photo. She sees me with the clarinet. And she says, this is you. I said, yes. And she said, okay, you can take these photos. So then I explained to her about the 20 Brisbane Street, right? And I'm looking at photos. An hour later, she comes back with this old dusty book, and she puts it right in front of me. She opens it up, and there, guess what? There's a picture of 20 Brisbane Street there, a photograph of the block that my mother lived in. So, so synchronicity, got Brisbane Street, and now we're going to add a few more. The next day on our walk to the library, my wife and I decide to stop at St. Mary's Cathedral, a beautiful, oldest cathedral in Australia. beautiful. We say some prayers. We light some candles for people, take some photos. We walk outside, and there's the Archibald Fountain. There's something about it that's very striking. It's a beautiful, it's almost like those Romanesque columns that are all over Rome. We take some pictures there. We go to the library. I open up, start looking at more pictures. Guess what we find? We find a picture of my grandfather standing at Archibald's Fountain in the same place where my wife took a picture of me. And then we're reading more documents, and I come upon a document that just blew me away. I look at it. It's my parents' marriage certificate. Vivian Hugh to William Leong, married 1945 in St. Mary's Cathedral. I weep. This is the synchronicities happening over and over and over again. And then I look reading letters, and I see a stack of family documents. Now, I'm taking pictures of all of this. So one of the documents is the location of where my grandparents are born. So we decide to take an Uber out the next day, and we get to the cemetery, which is really large, much larger than any cemetery we've seen in the United States. We find my grandmother's gravesite. We lay flowers, and we say prayers, and then we decide to find my grandfather's. Now, I was named after my grandfather. His name was Stuart. That's my middle name, David Stuart Leong. And we're looking for section 29C, where my grandfather is buried. I said, this is really important for me to find. We walk, we can't find it. We look all over 29C, cannot find it. And I said, Patty, I'm not going to leave until I find it. Up on the hill, you know, about a couple hundred yards away, there's a public toilet. We said, let's go up there, take a break. I sit down. Patty comes out of it. She says, David, look. I said, what? She goes, look, diagonally across from where I was sitting was my grandfather's headstone. We walked out of 29C where it said my father. We went to 30C, 31, and we're sitting in 32, and there, what I thought to be 32, and there's my grandfather's gravesite right there. And for some reason, I looked up and it said 29C, so either we made a mistake or whatever. So we say our prayers. It was just a loving, wonderful moment. And then we start to leave. And we are walking out of the cemetery. And we're walking to the road to call for an Uber cab. And what happens is a car pulls up right in front of us. The car pulls up. A family gets out. They leave the door open to the car. They walk to a gravesite. And when they leave the door open, there's a little tinkling sound. You know the sound of an ice cream truck when that happens? A little jingling sound? There, the song that was playing when they left the door open was Waltzing Matilda. And we looked at each other, and I said, Patty, listen, you hear that? My mother never got to go back to Sydney. But somehow, I believe she knew we were going to bring her back. And I said, welcome home, Mom.
Amazing. That's just not even, that is so awesome. So incredible. You know, the portals and the symbolic things that happen in our lives are so indescribable. So indescribable. You know, all of your stories, especially the ones that you told today, tonight, contained a very vivid aha moment. You even used that. A wonderful storyteller by the name of Elizabeth Ellis, she's a professional teller here in Texas, says you've got stories that are aha, uh-huh, ah, or ah, you know, she talks about it. But yours are, definitely aha, okay, you got some aha moments.
Uh-huh.
Those times, you know, the moment frozen in time that ultimately defines us. Tough question, but if you had to choose one, I mean, only one, aha lesson that you want us to extract from your stories, what would it be?
I would say dig deep into your life's biggest challenges, and I think somewhere in there is your ninja skill. It's something that most of us run away from, Sometimes people don't even touch it in their whole life, but I think if you tap into it, there's a treasure there.
Are we afraid to find it, or are we afraid to know what to do with it?
I think we're afraid to find it because it scares us.
Yeah.
And that it scared me when I was in therapy with John Parakis. I was running away from it. And I mean, I ran away from it for, you know, for 45 years. And I think, and there was a book I read recently, Brian F. Martin, who is the sort of founding father of the National Domestic, Children of Domestic Violence Association. He wrote a book called Invincible. And he even says in his book, everyone that has gone through, that has witnessed domestic violence or gone through it, you know, assuming you've lived through it, there is something from that that sustains you and can you can use as to help you in life. And it is, it can enrich you. And again, I call that my ninja skill. But that book, Brian F. Martin's book on children of domestic violence and what it can do for you, called Invincible. We all have invincible skills if we're willing to dig deep enough.
Yeah. Great insight. Great insight. Another element, a key element in your stories, and this includes the TED Talk that I posted on Facebook, is your commitment to give back to a defined cluster of people, or, you know, you have a target audience. And all of your stories just speak vividly about your desire to give back. And something tells me that giving back is what lies ahead for David Leon. Tell us about that.
You know, as this part of my life, I really want to talk with people. I want to meet people. I want to talk to people either through Zoom. I want to talk to them. I think I've got something to say. I want to hear their stories and offer what I can, because I really do believe that we are all invincible in some way. If there's, that's what I want to give back. I want to work with you know, survivors of domestic violence. I want to talk with them. I want to hear their stories. I want to share my stories, and I think I can grow, and I believe that other people can grow. We can all grow together. I you know, so please reach out to me, email me, contact, however, I really want to do this.
I have your contact information on our Facebook page, but give it to us again.
Well, my website is davidsleong.com. And my email is just right in the email me, dsleong@me.com.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, you know, your work takes you to so many contexts. You really are a professional that fields multiple contexts. And I know that you deal with a lot of health professionals. I mean, it's just a plethora of groups of people. And I'm really proud of the fact that you do that, because communication is everything when it comes to enhancing the healing process. You know, it's you talked about digging deep, finding your ninja skills. We've done so many programs on this show over the years about really looking at communication and storytelling in particular as a mechanism by which we learn to heal. And I think that is so important. But, you know, another this is a little quiz here, David, get ready. Another thing that you do, you teach in the business school, you teach elevator talks. Now, here you go. Now, we got 30 seconds, so this is perfect, right?
Because you,
okay, I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but we all want to hear a 30-second elevator pitch. Can you give us one? I know that usually we'd have to pay a lot of money for this, But go ahead, 30-second elevator.
My elevator, if someone said, hey, you know, if I were pitching myself, let's say, I would say something like, I create teams of people, I create trust on teams of people who like to fight. I usually find out, like, what is the value that you can bring. You bring, well, let me just start again.
I'll ask you the question. You know, I don't know much about you. You say you're a fight master. Tell us what you can bring to the table.
I create teams of people who collaborate well. I create teams of people who develop trust, and with that, they can develop superior product.
I love it. Okay. Generic enough, valid, very applicable. I asked my listeners, you know, are you going to hire this guy? I think the answer is probably yes. This was a ball. This was fun. And we're going to do this again, right? I want to tell everybody that I really want to be David Leon because I'm looking at him right now on Zoom, and he's got a lake in his backyard. He has a lake. Is this guy well paid or what? Oh my God! Thank you, David Leon, fight master, professor, and in my opinion, a narrative maestro for your wisdom and insight, but most of all, for demonstrating how personal storytelling unleashes the power of spirit and growth. We're going to do this again. Good friends are always together in spirit, and you and our renewal proves that, right?
Absolutely. Beautiful. A pleasure. It was absolutely fabulous. I love you, Hank. Thank you so much. Thank you all.
Feelings mutual. Another great set of stories. You know, on behalf of our team at So What's Your Story, I want to thank all of you, our listeners, for spending time with us every week. Please stay safe, smart, and keep telling stories to remind you that none of us are as good as all of us. Stay put, because Lars is up next with a Tennyson tape deck, a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. When you're relaxing, driving home, or just chilling, tune in every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and for the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Have friends in other cities who wish they had access to some of the great programming you hear on this station and the Pacifica Radio Network, we have a website for you.
PacificaNetwork.org gives community radio stations like this one complete information on how to become a Pacifica affiliate and information for listeners looking for community radio stations that air Pacifica programming.
With the launch of PacificaNetwork.org, Pacifica Radio is bringing together frequently requested items regarding Pacifica as a network.
Nearly 100 radio stations.
From Carbondale, Colorado to Benwood, West Virginia.
From Bend, Oregon to Hobbs Ferry, New York.
From Moscow, Idaho to Chicago, Illinois.
Have all made a statement by linking up and carrying Pacifica radio programming.
So tell your far-flung friends about PacificaNetwork.org to connect communities.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. Crunchy, ripe apples are a fall treat, but in many areas, growing apples is becoming more difficult as the climate changes. In the Midwest, for example, orchards are experiencing increasingly hot and wet weather.
What it's done is made fungal diseases more and more of a problem later and later in the season.
Rami Abaromia owns Adams to Apples, an organic orchard in Wisconsin. To improve his yields, he grows disease-resistant strains like Honeycrisp. And he has planted his trees closer together so that they can grow on trellises, almost like grapevines.
So there's a lot more light and air that's going into the tree, so that means less disease.
Abaromia also prunes his trees to promote good air circulation. And when needed, he applies an organic fungicide. But even if the fruit looks great, rain can cause other problems for apple growers. For example, wet weather can deter customers from visiting U-Pick orchards that also offer hayrides and other fall fun. So Abaromia says if the trend towards wetter weather continues, the industry will need to adapt.
I think there's going to need to be a lot of sharing between growers to say, okay, this is what works, so you got to do this to be able to succeed.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude, heard wicked early on KPFT 90.1 FM. I originate on a little community radio station, WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire. But like our big brother, KPFT, this definition of community radio ties us together. Quote, "It should be made clear that community radio is not about doing something for the community, but about the community doing something for itself. In other words, owning and controlling its own means of communication." Close quote. I love this definition from AMARC Africa. So, folks, if you